Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira. And today, as we continue our celebration of Black History Month, we've already covered an ode to our churches. And today we're jumping into a celebration of our schools, historically Black colleges and universities.
So I didn't get the chance to go.
Okay.
Well, actually, is that right? No, I didn't get a chance to go.
No, you didn't.
I got scholarships to a couple schools that were not HBCUs.
Mm-hmm. As did I.
And at the time, money was the biggest determining factor in where I ended up going.
True.
So I ended up not having this experience that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, I found.
But you did.
I did. I think money was continues to be a determining factor in where a student will ultimately go. But when I found myself making these decisions about 4 or 7 years ago, I received a full scholarship to a HBCU. I received a partial scholarship to Clark Atlanta. I received some, you know, hits here and there, mm-hmm. achievement, whatever, from other schools. But I was blessed to receive a full scholarship to Bowie State. So that opened a door for me. That secured my access to higher education, and it's like I took that opportunity and I've run with it, and I know I could run further and run harder, but I just want to shine a light on our schools because they are a constant reminder, a monument, if you will, to the persistence and the resilience of Black scholarship in this country. And they are beacons of light. They are access points to an aspect of Black American culture. So we're going to talk about them today, and we're going to highlight some of the relationship that they have to our other institutions, such as the Black Church.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why I didn't end up going is because at the time, you know, 17-year-old kid,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't really, so we had a different world on.
Yes.
And I loved that environment, that atmosphere that they created.
Mm-hmm.
But I also didn't have an appreciation for what these schools offer.
Yeah.
And so my experience at a non-HBCU, that was my first college experience. I thought this was normal until I started talking to my friends at HBCUs. And I'm like, wait, y'all look out for each other? Like, y'all, and you know what? They sold us. And it, I mean, this is an HBCU show, so I'm not going to talk about my PWI that I went to.
But you should.
But
because
one of the ways that I was sold, mm-hmm. was you could go to this HBCU with 4,000 students, or you could go to this school with 6,000 Black students. And so I'm like, well, it's, you know, I can still have the experience, but it's not anywhere near
yeah.
the experience that I had described to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I missed out.
Well, I mean, there's always, I don't know, another master's
degree.
Oh,
when I go, I'm going to spend some money. I'm going to spend some money at HBCU for sure.
At, you know, and we're going to get into that later. So, you know, our schools exist just for background. Where did these schools come from? Prior to the Civil War, you had two major social movements in the United States. One was for women's rights, mm-hmm. and the other one was for abolition. And there were different intervals where these movements kind of interacted with one another. Most notably, you would have speakers like Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth who would appear at speaking events that were geared towards women's rights, but just trying to engage the audience in the continuum of the conversation. So there are these movements happening, these social movements happening, and they're happening throughout the country, regardless of whether or not that is an area of the country that participates in slavery. So that's the backdrop. And at the crescendo of these movements, let's say starting after 1835 or so, the question of education, intentional education for Blacks in America becomes the question, mm-hmm. because a lot of women are moving and pushing for the opportunity, amongst other things, to be recognized for their intellect, and they still have to operate within these spheres of influence. So it was thought that a natural progression of a woman's presence in the home would be for her to continue to working with children as a teacher, you know, somebody who's respected in the community. I don't think anybody ever meant for these women to be, you know, lifelong teachers or PhD level professors. It was just this is what you're good at and this is what you could do. And they themselves wanted access to the education. Blacks had the same desire, the same persistence. You know, once we achieve any sort of security for ourselves, or if you're talking about freeing somebody who up until the day they are freed, it is illegal for them to know how to read and write. How do you then make them a functioning member of society without looking at their literacy, looking at their capacity to learn? So a subset of these movements became, how do we educate the people? What you begin to see is, and it's very important to note, that these movements were anchored by people of faith, people who were ministers or who likened themselves to be what we would call now a social justice advocate, warrior, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they were affiliated with their churches. Mm-hmm. So Presbyterian churches, Quaker communities were known to be benevolent toward the condition of Blacks, whether they be free or enslaved. And developing this answer to this need, people began to form classes, schools. So because of the fact that the laws were not flexible in this, a lot of these early engagements were informal, They were secretive, and they were private, meaning they probably happened within the home where there's no witnesses. Because in certain situations, you're taking a chance with your life to educate somebody else. So We have examples of people being able to read and write, but then the question becomes, who taught you?
Right.
Okay. So in 1837, a Presbyterian minister in Pennsylvania started a class, a group called the African Institute. And he meant for this to be a place where free Blacks could study their Bibles and learn how to read and write. Usually this was used. The Bible was a textbook. The Bible as a textbook. If I teach you how to use that, how to read that, even in a limited fashion, I can then teach you lettering, numbering, because these things occur in the Bible. When we quote scripture, we're saying a book, a number, and a number. So using these as platforms and then to just kind of begin to have a standardized engagement, we start the Africa Institute. The Africa Institute grows to become what we know as Cheney University. So that will be our first HBCU. Prior to 1837, prior to the establishment of the Africa Institute, you did have examples of Blacks receiving some sort of education and being present in American higher education. But the examples are very few and far between. So the first record that we have of a Black person attending college was a young man who attended what became Washington and Lee University in Virginia in 1799. There is no record of his graduation, right? And you say in Virginia?
1799.
Yes, Virginia in 1799. And there could be a host of reasons why he was even admitted. I don't have that information, but the first recorded graduation of a Black student from college is Alexander Lucius Twilight. Lucius.
That's awesome.
Okay. This is an extremely Black
Lucius
name.
Twilight. Yes. That's something else.
But he graduated with a bachelor's degree from Middlebury College in Vermont in 1823. So even from 1799 to 1823, we don't have the achievement of the graduation. Other early graduates to other schools, they are usually clustered in New England. And in New England at this time, so New England states being Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, these are areas that are emerging as staunchly anti-slavery, but probably haven't made much sense of equity yet. And the people who have been admitted into these schools are preparing for either what we would now call preparing for careers, but they are studying law, or they are studying medicine, or they are studying religion.
It's interesting that some of these schools, a fair amount of them, were started by people of faith. So you mentioned the Presbyterian minister starts what becomes Cheney University.
Mm-hmm.
William Tennant, also a Presbyterian minister, starts law colleges in Pennsylvania, which ultimately become Princeton. So there's ministers that start all of these faith-based schools. So That's just like, so you got a set of schools like Princeton, Yale, Dartmouth, and Harvard. all of these schools are started by ministers, and in this point in 2020, they're Ivy League schools.
Yes.
We have another set of schools started by ministers that in 2020 are HBCUs that are fighting for survival in many cases.
Yeah. But we bring these points up because you have to highlight the different purpose. So the first wave of schools are established to educate the landed gentry of the newly formed America. So a lot of what we refer to as Ivy League schools were started prior to the United States or prior to us becoming a country.
Yeah, they were started to train people in ministry and different professions.
Yeah, ministry, law, and medicine were really your biggest, like, we're not, at this point in time, apprenticeship is a way that people are learning and acquiring skills. So you're not necessarily going to college to become an engineer. You are going to have a regimented study that looks like monastery study in Europe. So starting with that model, we're establishing institutions of higher education, and they are not meant to be these wide open access points that we now venerate like our public institutions to be. They are private. They exist in plain sight, and they exist for mostly young white males. So again, speaking back to those social movements, you have women who are capable and who feel that they could conduct themselves in scholarly study of religion and have aspiration to be orators and speakers and ministers. They want to be what they see, but these doors are closed to them. And too many closed doors, you get pressure to knock that, you know, to knock them over, to push them open. So this is happening. These two movements are drawing energy off of one another because there's something very altruistic going on in the atmosphere where it's like, not so much if I get free, you get free. But if you help me get free.
Why are we talking about freedom?
If you help me, you know, achieve this particular goal, I'll help you too. And let's be clear, this women's movement is a white women's movement. Yeah. So I think what they underestimated over time is how patriarchal the structure would be in that men of color would experience certain access before white women did. And this is an ongoing, you know, conversation and just a development of this timeline. One thing that we highlight by showing the difference between the Ivy Leagues and the HBCUs is that the churches are involved in the development of both. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, education is not something that is coded and cemented in the Constitution as something that needs to be provided. It is provided for under, I believe, the 10th Amendment, in that it's left to the states on how it's provided. We don't have a federal Department of Education until the 20th century. So now you have the African Institute, founded prior to slavery's ending, offering itself as a place of study where blacks could study in peace, which is hugely important, over a course of study. It does not become a degree granting institution for almost another 100 years until 1932. But a lot of our schools develop as these classes that grow into more until they can be called colleges, till they're fully staffed out, and then a number of programs will qualify you to be known as a university. In 1854, the Ashman Institute was established, also in Pennsylvania. This goes on to become Lincoln University. So we consider these two our two oldest HBCUs. So what is important to see is that small religious communities were making headway in establishing schools that they intended to reflect the mission of meeting the needs of the wretched. And this is just how, whether that was a paternalistic view or whether they really felt that way, they wanted it to be on the historical record that when it came time to get involved, they got involved in a very structured way, which was education. Wilberforce is the site of a station on the Underground Railroad. So there's already a community there that is displaying and demonstrating the benevolence toward these classes of people. And they just established, you know, what becomes the school. My beloved Bowie State University. Mm-hmm. There's some dispute, but a number of schools were established, let's say, between 1860 and 1882. a lot of the energy behind Reconstruction really forced the question of, we now have 4 million skilled yet unskilled people who do not know how to represent themselves. Now, keep in mind, in the greater population of America, you have millions of people who are uneducated. Millions. You have millions of poor whites who are uneducated by any measure of what we would use today to say, okay, you completed eighth grade or high school or whatever. School grades are different. So what starts out as, when we say, oh, you went, you know, you attended what became Cheney, you attended what became Lincoln, you attended what became Bowie. Bowie started out as the Baltimore Normal School. It was in Baltimore City, and someone bequeathed us the land in Bowie, Maryland, mm-hmm. to build a school. But these schools existed just to give a foundational education. It was not what we experience today, K through 12. When you've completed your course of study, it might be equivalent to an eighth grade education. Mm-hmm. So it was really just to bring you up to speed again so that you could conduct your affairs. You've never been able, it was illegal for you to be party to a contract. You didn't read it. You just did what somebody told you to do. Mm-hmm. Now you can, you know, with some degree of confidence, enter into a contract. How do you get a job? How do you understand how much you're going to be paid? How do you know where to live? How do you know how to read? Not just knowing your way around, but reading signs and knowing what shops offer and knowing what the newspaper says. So there's this need that needs to be filled on a literacy standpoint. So our schools are becoming established, and the church is right there in lockstep, assisting with, one, the provision of space, the provision of staff to teach, the provision of security, because as these schools are being established, they are immediate targets for resistance and retaliation. Mm-hmm. And some of our schools are in what are now urban areas, you know, like Howard. Everybody knows Howard, the Mecca. It's in Washington, D.C. Howard is, I believe, either the only one or one of maybe three that benefits from a direct congressional earmark to help with their funding. So you might hear things about Howard, the financial ups and downs, but they are one of the few schools that, regardless of what is happening at the federal level, Congress has an endowment for them. They get money.
Yeah, that endowment conversation is, we brought that up when we were talking about funding ministries.
Mm-hmm.
This is also applicable to funding educational institutions, where money is donated, not just bequeathed in death, but right, just donated. And so the level of endowments between these HBCUs and predominantly white institutions, the PWIs, it's a vast difference between the two. The schools that I was looking at in Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
that was, oh, Southern.
Uh-huh.
$13 million in endowments. And down the street in LSU, $500 million in endowments.
Yep.
And so that's the level of funding disparity that these schools are contending with when they're mm-hmm. trying to recruit students and talent to come to these institutions to learn in an environment that's safe for them,
right,
that is sensitive to the history and how these things got there, who, and actually with faculty that may have come through the same route. And so there's mm-hmm. a different level of respect there. I mean, the fact that these schools still exist is amazing, just considering the level of resources that they've had to work around.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, we acknowledge it, but it is, that to me is a manifestation of the system within which the school has to exist anyway. So we are within an unequal educational environment that starts prior to kindergarten. It starts with exactly what school is your child going to go to. And this conversation is more so about the celebration of that resilience that has us able to even talk about HBCUs in 2020, because the hate is real. I mean, there's a lot of misunderstanding about their, you know, what is their purpose, what was their purpose, and what is their purpose. But the purpose is still the same. It's Black scholars taking care of Black scholars. So it's scholarship that has been made inclusive to include us. So George Washington Carver, which we mentioned on a different show, he is able to develop the 300 plus uses for the peanut because of his professorship and his residency at Tuskegee University. These things go hand in hand. We don't have him as the scientist and the inventor and the example that we end up speaking highly of without there being an incubator for him and an incubator for his scholarship at Tuskegee. And Tuskegee, we know, was established by Booker T. Washington, who, after Reconstruction, had a different idea of what it would mean for newly freed blacks to be successful in a world where they have to earn a wage. They have to, you know, they're going to have to learn how to work with a community and work amongst people that are used to owning them. Like, let's just keep this thing real. His ideas were different. A lot of people might have a surface understanding of the difference of opinion when it comes to higher education between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. Washington went to Hampton, okay? So Booker T. Washington attends Hampton Institute, which itself is HBCU, and he grows to offer this theory on development for the African-American workforce. So he himself is a scholar who has passed through an HBCU, who goes to establish a school that is going to do what? It's going to take very seriously how it lays out the steps of achievement that it intends for its students to take to be palatable, to become employable within the system that they have to work in. Du Bois, on the other hand, goes to a majority institution. He is a Harvard graduate. And Harvard is Ivy League and known very well as Ivy League at this point. And he speaks of, regardless of what school you go to contend with the best of what is being produced at these, you know, what we now call PWIs. So even his theory on African-American development is take all of yourself into every room that you go into and don't be afraid of, you know, your white counterpart in those rooms, because we're just as good as them and we don't have to prepare to serve them or prepare in a way that centers them. His whole thing is, not that I agree with it one way or the other, but what Du Bois offered is, I'm just as good as you. I might be better. So his ideas had more to do with, don't train me on how to be a better domestic. Don't train me on how to be a better laborer. I came here to study law. I'm going to be a lawyer. I intended to study medicine. I'm going to study medicine. So really what you see in the development of HBCU curriculums, especially after we get to establish these public colleges through a process called state land grants, is that you had programs that, let's say, focused on machinery and agriculture because they're preparing you for an agrarian society, an economy in transition. So when we talk about schools like Alabama A&M, you know, North Carolina A&T, where do these names come from? They come from the fact that the core of the curriculum was meant to train you in what?
Agriculture.
Agriculture. Some of the private schools, the institutes, Tuskegee Institute becomes Tuskegee University, Hampton Institute, the same. Howard, the same. These are private institutions. They had a little bit more of a diversity in their offerings, and they had assistance in developing the highest iteration of a program. So you didn't have to go to Howard and just be satisfied with a bachelor's degree. Howard was able, because of funding, endowments, strong alumni networks, you establish a school of law. That school of law is responsible for Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah.
You establish a school of medicine. That school of medicine is responsible for Charles Drew. The law school gives us Thurgood Marshall. These are also places where black families who have done well or who are well connected can send their children to become educated. One of the outstanding examples is Strom Thurmond's daughter. She attended South Carolina State University, which was a black college in her state. Her father was a Dixiecrat. Her father was somebody who believed in segregationism and who hid her in plain sight from people who might have had impolite conversation about her existence. But again, it was a well-kept, well-known secret that she was living an independent life in South Carolina, her father being the senator who paid for her to go to school and, you know, opened her access to this higher education. He was not out of her life, but it's not like she went to Clemson. Mm-hmm. She went to South Carolina State. Our HBCUs, they are a cultural resource that we draw from in pop culture, that we draw from in our artistic endeavors, and they deserve to be highlighted. Last year, the biggest concert event was, or 2 years ago, was Beyonce presenting Homecoming. And Homecoming wasn't just any old Homecoming. Homecoming resonated with an audience that has seen these things or has experienced Black culture around bands, football, and ultimately our schools. This doesn't even happen when at a PWI where, let's say, the majority of the football players are African American, but the school itself is not, right? So you talk about these endowments, but let's also talk about these disparities.
Yeah. I wanted to, one of the reasons why I was looking at HBCUs, because I wanted to go, I was looking at the Bayou Classic and I wanted to go Grambling or Southern or something. And I went to, it was a marching band camp at University of Maryland. So it was predominantly white band. And we were out, you know, marching on the field, working on formations and stuff like that. Now, I had marched in Black bands my entire career. And to be out on the field, making sure your heels go down first and all that stuff. I'm like, why is my heel going down before my toe? I'm supposed to just be just lifting my whole leg at the same time. I'm supposed to be dipping. It's a whole lot. And I was just like, man, this is not even anywhere near what I mean.
It's very different.
Yeah, I heard.
I mean, we talked about A Different World earlier, and just, I believe that show continues to be a gift to us because it put our schools in the center. So the mythical or the imagined Hillman College is not much different from what you would find at a Bowie State, a Virginia State, a Hampton, a Howard. It exists, and the types of students that you find there exist. So just like, so these are not just party schools. These are not intended to be that. These are places that when other schools would not let you in, this is where you could go to earn your degree in your professional endeavor. So these schools actually produced and began and aided in creating a Black middle class that then can do different things in the community. So when you did not have access to healthcare because of, you know, let's say segregation policies or even affordability or even transportation, 9 times out of 10, our schools are educating people who can serve you where you are, right? So you can't go to the bigger hospital that only serves whites at the time. You have to go to Freedmen's Hospital, and the doctors that work at Freedmen's Hospital actually were educated at a host of medical schools, but they might have gone to, for undergrad, to qualify for medical school, to one of our institutions. Your safety being very important. During civil rights movement, the students sitting at the lunch counter in Greensboro are enrolled at that time at North Carolina A&T. And I think it was last year, visiting my niece who graduated from A&T, they honored those students who found themselves in the middle of a cultural battle for equal rights in little old Greensboro at the time, who did not have access to their dorms, had their graduation activities cut short, and had to come back 50 years later for those who survived to be honored the right way. You know, they're in caps and gowns just like my niece is, and she's, you know, I'm not alive when this happens. Our schools are also holders of our historical record. Outside of the cultural highlights, I think these schools continue to be important, especially in the educational environment that we're in, because here is a place where the Black experience is centered. Black students having 4.0s, Black students being involved or being interested in the technical sciences, being interested in the arts, being interested in math, Black students who want to write books, who want to study history, who want to do archaeological digs that mean something to our community. They're not different. They don't stand out. They are one of 500, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 at our largest institutions of those minds that come together to do that. And they see one another. And they serve the communities in which the schools are actually established.
So I guess for HBCUs, one of the reasons why I didn't go is because I didn't see the value. So in looking forward, I'm conscious of my kids seeing these as schools that are worth their attention. So what ways do we do that to condition our kids that you don't go to the biggest schools or the biggest name school, Ivy League school, whatever. These right. schools over here, they're going to take care of you in ways that these other schools can't.
That you can't even imagine. So I think that families do develop these legacies. You do have families that have centered on certain schools, and that's where all the kids go, like Spelman and Morehouse, Clark, you know, the family sending their kids, sending next generations to those schools. Howard has that where, I'm in a sorority. So like a founder in that sorority, their grandchild goes to Howard, and it's two layers because not only are they going to Howard, but maybe they're trying to be in the sorority as well. And it's just a beautiful thing. But there's this example that just comes to mind where you have to inform your kids about the value from your standpoint too. So we talk about cost and access. And I met these women last year at an event, the McKissick sisters. Long story short, their dad was an engineer architect in Tennessee, and he was extremely good at what he does. The wife is pregnant, and this is before sonograms and all of this. So he thinks he's having a boy. He thinks he's having boys, and he buys all of this boy-oriented toys and things, trains, building blocks and things of this nature. Lo and behold, he has twin girls, and he doesn't take back any of the toys. He gives them the toys.
I spent my money on these toys. These are good toys.
These are good toys, and y'all are going to play with these toys. But he gives them all of these, you know, seemingly boy-oriented toys and interests. He's their dad, so he's showing them what he does. He's taking them to work with him. He's informing them of their family legacy. Come to find out, they come from a long line of carpenters and architects who did very well in Tennessee, which is the Upper South. They were so good at what they did. They got contracts from the state to build, even when white companies were available. So they have this established line of, we're good at this. This is what we do. This is why he bought those toys. It comes time for the girls to go to school, and they were both top students. They could have went anywhere. And he said, you can go anywhere, but I'm only paying for you to go to a HBCU. The girls ended up going to Howard. They went to Howard, and they majored in engineering and architecture. And the McKissick sisters are the ones who built the Blacksonian down on the mall.
Wow.
So their company has grown. They, you know, they've brought all of this modern knowledge to this family business that they've been able to hold on to for over 100 years. And they're getting those big multi-million dollar contracts. They're building the new terminal at LaGuardia Airport. That's huge. But the McKissick sisters, their dad just said, I ain't paying for it unless you go to this particular school. And the community is tight-knit and real. I just saw them again at an event for the National Council of Negro Women. So it's like, these are our institutions. And this is something to be venerated. He treated that as something to be honored. We said something off recording about funding and inequity. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind this historical, you know, this example that I'm giving you in spite of the fact that the funding has never been equal. But I don't think it was ever designed to be equal. I don't think that people ever thought to invest in our schools for what we then are able to invest in our community by what, you know, the things that we do, the things that we build. That conversation is evolving because we now have the minds that are able to litigate the cases that are supposed to bring us parity. We now have the leadership, you have to hope, that is able to represent us at the highest levels of government to advocate for us. Puppetry persists no matter what. You know, people always want to parade out Black leaders and Black faces trying to attract Black voters, blah, blah, blah. But here's the truth. These schools exist because a lot of doors are still closed to our students. And our schools take great care with our children. They are designed to do that. I'm not saying that they do it any better than any other type of institution, but it is very different.
There is something to be said about the fact that you're right, that they weren't designed to be at least funded equally or on equal footing. But what happens after students graduate from these institutions, they're forced to compete and expected to be able to compete with people who have been in a different situation. It reminds me of, remember when in the Rocky movies where there would always be like a training montage, and like, say, for instance, Rocky IV, when Drago's training in this like state-of-the-art gym.
Yeah.
And Rocky's out banging meat and doing all this other stuff. And the reason why that means so much is because people root for that underdog to say, look at where they've come from. They didn't have all the resources, and he's still expected to compete with someone else. That's what these students do. And for HBCUs, this is the last stop in many cases before they're out amongst the world, where they're out of that safety and security. It's not just safety and security. It's also things that you would learn that you just wouldn't know. So, for instance, you go into a predominantly white employment situation. Are you equipped to understand why those microaggressions hurt the way they do? Ooh. Or where did you learn that? Because I didn't learn it in my school. I had to learn it on my own. But to be able to have the language to articulate that and to say, wait, we're not going to do that here, and this is the reason. I had a situation at my job this week. They were talking about the coronavirus. And someone, I'm not going to say who the person is because it's pretty high, but they said, we need to get this under control. This reminds me of Katrina. And so I said, no, this is absolutely nothing like Katrina. Over 1,800 Americans died in Katrina. Zero Americans have died in this. But it takes being armed with the knowledge to be able to refute those in the moment. And I am convinced that I didn't get that at the PWI.
So it's a gauntlet. You know, I working with students, I always tell them it's easier to get into college than it is to get out. I value my experience because it wasn't the smoothest. And I do think I have a little bit of grit in making sure that I meet my goals, regardless of what the outside circumstances might be. And during our time at Bowie, I remember that out of nowhere, seemingly to us as students, looking for land in the county to put a trash transfer station. And a trash transfer sounds exactly like what it is. It's where we take your trash before we decide where what ultimate landfill it goes to. And of all the land in Prince George's County, they say, oh, no, it's got to go on the other side of the tracks from the university. Never mind that that was the side of the campus that had our dorms on it, which means that anything downdraft, and we didn't have air conditioning at the time. This is, you know, this is actually 2000 when this is going on. We didn't have air conditioning on that side of the yard. We didn't have all of the different facilities. We were just building a new building. And one thing I learned at Bowie was the advocacy, you know, how to engage the mechanisms. We were down in Annapolis giving testimony about how this would affect us and harm us as students. And even though we were probably fighting for the whole town, it was myself and two of my friends who ended up, you know, taking that advocacy position. But that was the beginning of our leadership. And our leadership is evident right now. We've gone from being those students to being top educator in Prince George's County Schools, being an executive director of a mentoring organization that serves Prince George's County in D.C. And I do all sorts of interesting things on behalf of people in this particular state. So these are incubators of our leadership, our scholarship. They are holders of our history. And these are sacred spaces that celebrate our culture.
We need these spaces.
We need these spaces. I alluded you guys to taking care of our things. So our schools are a part of our things. And you cannot take for granted your access points in other places. You cannot take for granted feeling welcome one day and feeling put out the next. And regardless of what your personal experience is, some other young person needs what a historically Black college and university has to offer. So in our raising our awareness of where our resources are needed, don't overlook our schools. We have to take care of our things.
And that means funding, too. So all of the funding should not come from outside sources. So
no.
Endowments and just donations just come from us. So like I said, I didn't go there, but I'm definitely giving my money.
And we appreciate you.
So HBCU. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether I get a degree or not is not the issue. I want to make sure that if I got something to give, I mm-hmm. want to make sure those schools are supported.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about funding churches. These institutions also need funding. We
yes,
talked about the
do.
Disparity. Let's take care of our things.
Let's take care of our things.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.